Hartman program.
Tom Hartman.
Welcome to the Free Speech Zone.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Some interesting, very interesting math going on here in the Democratic primaries. And I'm very curious to get your thoughts on this as well, but I just want to share with you my take on it. And also, I want to get into the Dalai Lama, His Holiness the Dalai Lama, and Darfur. I have some fairly strong opinions on this, having spent a week with the Dalai Lama at his home in Dharamsala back about eight, nine years ago or so, and you know, stayed in touch with some of those folks over the years, and also having been in Darfur 3 weeks ago, and you know, what's going on with that. So, you know, this whole China thing. So I want to get into these two things in our first hour. By the way, James Hoffa is going to be dropping by in our second hour, at the end of our second hour, the general president of the International Brotherhood of Teamsters. But in our second hour broadly, I want to ask the question, should Bush and company be prosecuted for war crimes? At what point? And how do we go about doing the prosecution of these guys for war crimes? Because it's increasingly evident, particularly with the information that just came out about these meetings, about, you know, how to execute war crimes, that we are being led, our nation is being led right now by criminals. And I know of no other way to say it. And I don't consider that hyperbole, and I don't consider it, you know, slander or, you know, shock talk or anything like this. This isn't like, you know, something dopey like calling somebody a name. I'm talking about the classical clinical dictionary definition here. These guys are war criminals. And so anyhow, and then in our third hour, Kathy Zoya is going to drop by. She's the CEO of the Alliance for Climate Protection, which was profiled recently in Rolling Stone. Christy Harvey is going to be by with the news that's under the radar. And, of course, Ellen Ratner will be dropping by in our third hour as well. So our third hour will be a little guest heavy. Our first and second hour is mostly calls. But here's the deal with this, with the elections. First of all, there has been this shift in strategy on the part of the Clinton campaign over the last, and I've been watching this for the last week or so. It seemed like it happened on one day, but I'm not sure I could identify the day. But John Corzine started out. He said, "I'm a very aggressive supporter of President Clinton. I think you need at least a popular vote." And by the way, blogging over at Newsweek.com, Andrew Romano talking about this. And then Jack Murtha has a conversation on the air with Chris Matthews and in Huffington Post with Sam Stein that in order for Hillary Clinton to be selected by the delegates, which in and of itself starts to seem a little odd. In order for her to be selected by the delegates, if she doesn't win the delegates at the convention in Denver, that she is going to have the popular vote in her pocket. So all of a sudden, there's all this conversation about the popular vote, and on the Clinton side, and it raises the question, why would this be the issue when the Democratic Party rules say that it's the delegates? And also, of course, what are we going to do about Michigan and Florida? So, first of all, with regard to the popular vote versus the delegate vote, there are a number of states that, you know, so far we've had 46 states or territories. 40 of the 46 states or territories that are going to hold primaries or caucuses have released precise undisputed popular vote totals. This is Andrew Romano writing over Newsweek. And Real Clear Politics breaks it out and lays it out. And basically you have Barack Obama with 13,300,000 votes, more or less, and Hillary Clinton with 12,600,000 votes. And then you've got these other six states that didn't issue clear numbers. Two of them are Florida and California, and I'll get to those in just a second. And the other four states, Iowa, Nevada, Maine, and Washington, all held caucuses. And the argument, and there have been some other caucus states where they simply took the number of people who showed up to caucus and said, okay, that's the number of votes, and considered those voters. Well, Obama has done very well in caucus states, and there's, you know, theories about why this is and why this isn't. My personal take is that I think, you know, David Sirota probably had a pretty good finger on this thing, that it has more to do with the nature of the states than the nature of caucus versus election. But nonetheless, Barack Obama has won more caucus states than Hillary Clinton. And in a caucus state, because people have to show up for the caucus, there are fewer voters. So this interesting study was done. There have been actually a couple of them suggesting that if you were to go into the caucus states and say, okay, in the caucus states, for example, using, again, this is Andrew Romano's piece over in Newsweek. If you were to use Minnesota as an example, Minnesota was a caucus state. And there were 73,115 people who showed up and caucused for Obama. And by the way, let me put a frame around this whole conversation. I am not in this conversation trying to take the position or taking the position that it is inevitable for Barack Obama or Hillary Clinton, or that either one of them should be winning or not winning, or that either one of them should leave the race. As I've said many times on this program, I think they're both great candidates. I do want to hear what the voters have to say in all these states. I think it's a marvelous thing that this thing is dragging. Now, there was a time when I was very concerned about this. Longtime listeners to this program know that maybe a month and a half, 2 months ago, I was starting to get very worried about how long this campaign was going on, and I thought it was doing a lot of harm to the party. As I've watched it happen, though, what I'm seeing, and particularly here in my own state of Oregon, where I live, here now, in our primary will be on May 20th. And as a result of this campaign continuing, we've had both Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton visit our state. We've got mind-boggling numbers of new voters who have registered as Democrats. And this isn't Rush Limbaugh's Operation Chaos. These are people who are new voters registering for the first time and registering as Democrats, and a lot of independents switching to Democrats. I think that what we're seeing, frankly, is a tidal wave, and this is the setup for it. Because of these primaries, because of this primary race all across the country, what's happening is people are coming out and they're registering to vote. And those people who are Hillary's constituents, people who are, you know, supporting her, are registering to vote. Those people who are Barack Obama's are registering to vote. So, it's all around. I'm actually quite enthusiastic about this thing. So with that said, let's go back and look at the numbers again, because I think that this is a Mark Penn strategy for Hillary Clinton, and I think she should abandon it. And I think she should be talking about policy differences and personality differences, and why she should be telling people why they should vote for her rather than trying to game the system. I think she'll have more success that way if she wants to win the nomination and ultimately the presidency. Because this is the strategy that they're pursuing. This is the Mark Penn strategy. And again, back to this quote. Minnesota, caucus state, 66% Obama, 32% Clinton. That yielded 73,000 votes for Obama, because that's how many people showed up for the caucus. And that's added into the margin, you know, the numbers that are quoted in the media, and Obama's 700,000 vote margin, popular vote. Those caucus voters are considered popular vote. Now, Wisconsin, which is right next door to Minnesota, and has a very similar electorate in terms of racial makeup, in terms of economic makeup, in terms of Democrats versus Republicans, in terms of kind of cultural makeup. I grew up in Michigan, you know, right across the lake from both these states. I have a lot of familiarity with them, and Wisconsin held a primary. And there, Obama won by 58 to 41. But his voter margin was several hundred thousand. So if Minnesota had held a primary instead of a caucus, Obama, instead of picking up 73,000 votes, would have picked up over 340,000 votes. So the bottom line on all this is that if we are going to follow Mark Penn's logic that it should be the popular vote, then we should probably assign to those caucus states the percentage of at least registered voters who could have voted, registered Democrats who could have voted in a closed primary, and split it by the percentage that the caucus went. Because that's what it probably would have been. And the downside of that for the Clinton campaign is that it means that Obama would have probably more than a million vote greater margin over Hillary Clinton right now than he has right now. So I think, frankly, that this strategy of always talking about the popular vote is a mistake. Which then brings up the question, what are we going to do about Michigan and Ohio? And I'll give you my thoughts on that right after this. 16 minutes past the hour, Michigan and Florida. It's the Tom Hartman program. Stick around.
Tom Hartman. Uncommon sense from the radical middle. This is the Tom Hartman program.
That we're fighting for, is it still our creed from shore to shore? After a soldier fights, should we read him his new rights? There's not that many to read anymore. Where's all the freedom that we're fighting for?
Yeah, good question. I want to ask Harriet Myers and Alberto Gonzalez, John Yoo, George Bush, and the other, frankly, not just war criminals, as I said, we'll talk about this in the second hour, but not just war criminals, but also criminals against the Constitution. I mean, can you believe that the Republican Congress, this was before the Democrats took control of Congress, passed the Military Commissions Act, doing away with habeas corpus, a law that's been in the books since 1215? Anyhow, I'll get into that rant in the next hour. Here's the thing about Michigan and Florida. First of all, if you look at all of the states where there were primaries held, other than Michigan, Florida, now there are a couple of exceptions, Alaska, which is heavily Republican, Arizona, which is John McCain's home state, Utah, which is, you know, heavily Republican and heavily Mormon, so there's a huge turnout for Mitt Romney. And Alabama, which is heavily Republican. Those four states, the number of Republicans who turned out was about the same as the number of Democrats who turned out. Okay. In all the other states, with the exception of two, and I think we can reasonably take those four states off the board for the reasons that I said. You know, Mitt Romney's state, John McCain's state, Alaska is kind of an anomaly, and Alabama all the Democrats in the House of Representatives in Alabama are, you know, their knees are knocking because there's these mass subpoenas and going on and all this stuff. So anyway, if you take those four off the table and you look at all of the other, plus Michigan and Florida, take those six off the table and you look at all the other states where primaries were held, or caucuses for that matter, if you could compare Republican and Democratic caucuses, but you can't because the Republicans were by and large holding elections. But if you look at all the other states where there were primaries, what you find is that the Democratic turnout outnumbered the Republican turnout 3-2. In other words, about half again more Democrats showed up to vote in their primaries than Republicans showed up to vote in their primaries. Right across the board, with those exceptions, those caveats that I've given you. Now, in Michigan and Florida, that was not the case. And it was not the case because the people of the Democrats of Michigan and Florida were told, don't bother. So you had people who showed up to vote because they wanted to vote down the ticket. You had people who showed up to vote because they figured, what the heck? You had people who showed up to vote because there were tax issues and bond issues and local issues and, you know, dog catcher and whatnot, things on the ballot. But they weren't voting for the top of the ticket. So, first of all, a strong argument can be made, and in fact is made by Wharton School professors Gregory Ninney and Glenn Hurwitz, that the Michigan and Florida votes are virtually irrelevant because the turnout for the Democrats was at or below the turnout for the Republicans. In other words, the Democrats didn't actually turn out to vote. At least the most energized, those who really cared. So what are we getting? So number one. Number two, obviously, in Michigan, Barack Obama was not even on the ballot. So what are we going to do? I think my own personal take on this is that is that delegates from Michigan and Ohio have to be seated, number one. Otherwise, you're going to have a party torn apart, and you're going to have two states that are critical to the election of the presidency where the Democrats feel totally screwed, totally disenfranchised. And we're on the air in three different stations in Michigan, and I think three, maybe four stations in Florida, so I'd love to hear from y'all on this. In Michigan, it seemed, and it's too late for a revote. It's too late. You know, back 3 months ago, I was calling for the party, for Howard Dean to step up to the plate and run caucuses in these two states, and firehouse caucuses. In other words, you know, where people actually go in and vote. It's called a caucus, though, because it's run by the party. If it's run by the state, it's called a primary. Some caucuses actually involved everybody just showing up and voting. Others involved the old Iowa way of people showing up and lobbying, basically, each other. So I called for the party to hold elections, essentially, in Michigan and Florida and let them revote it. And the party didn't do that. Howard Dean didn't do that. The thing got caught up in battles and whatnot. So my suggestion would be in Michigan, where the vote was clearly irrelevant because only Hillary Clinton's name was on the ballot, along with a couple other people who didn't make it to the final round. But John Edwards was not on the ballot. Barack Obama was not on a ballot. The major candidates were not. That in Michigan, they should simply split it down the middle. Give half the delegates to Barack Obama, give half the delegates to Hillary Clinton, and say, you guys have a seat at the convention. You really, you know, because Michigan really should participate. In Florida, at least all the names were on the ballot. Now, it could be argued that Hillary Clinton had high name recognition at that time in Florida and Barack Obama didn't. On the other hand, Clinton partisans would argue that Barack Obama was buying national ads on CNN at that time, so some folks in Florida actually saw Obama ads, even though nobody was supposed to be advertising in Florida. On the other hand, Obama partisans will say, yeah, but Hillary Clinton showed up on the day of the election after the polls were closed, but nonetheless showed up in Florida, and people knew she was coming. And that was viewed by some Florida voters as a tip of the hat to Florida by Hillary, or in other words, campaigning in the state. But nonetheless, I would say that the Florida delegate, let Hillary take the number of votes and the number of delegates that she had in Florida. It was a small majority, and give the rest to Barack Obama. That would be my conclusion for Florida. And let's just have this over with, and let's seat these delegations. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Time and the Mississippi River, she's a going dry. The interest is up and the stock market's down, and you're only getting mugged if you go downtown. I live back in the woods, you see, my woman and the kids and the dogs and me. I got a shotgun, a rifle, and a four-wheel drive, and a country boy can survive. Country folks can survive.
Oh, yes. I used to live back in the woods in Vermont with my wife and my dog.
I can fly with
just didn't have a shotgun. But a lot of my neighbors did, I'll tell you. You could carry in Vermont without a permit. Welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. As the Wall Street Journal noted, this is the Wall Street Journal back on March 19th. They said, based on record Democratic turnout in other states, Florida would have been expected to turn out an additional 1.15 million voters, and Michigan would have turned out another 715,000 voters if their voters had been told that their votes would count. So this makes it all very, very problematic. And frankly, we don't know who those extra voters would have voted for. I mean, you could argue, you know, Michigan and Florida are the kind of states where they would have been Hillary voters. You could argue that Barack Obama's bringing new people and young people into the race. They would have been Barack Obama voter. Either argument, I think, has some cogency. We've seen both happen in various states. So how should this be handled?
Charlie in Fort Lauderdale listening on WINS. Hey, Charlie, what's on your mind today? Hey, Tom, I have no idea how it could be handled, but I know that we had a record turnout down here in Florida. I think it was on the order of 3 or 4 to 1 Democrats over Republicans, by far the highest turnout ever in a primary.
Actually, according to the Wall Street Journal, according to the study done by the Wharton School, it was 1 to 1 Democrats. The Republicans had a record turnout as well.
The reporting I saw down here out of the Miami Herald and the Sun Sentinel had it, I think, 3 to 1, if I remember correctly. I'll go back and check. Secondly, it was a very consequential primary, even though the delegates aren't seated, because just after that, I think within hours, Edwards and Giuliani dropped out. And I just wanted to...
Oh, hang on just a minute. If I may, Charlie, if I may simply correct myself here, I was wrong. It wasn't 3 to 1 against or 1 to 1 or whatever against the Republicans. Set aside the Republican vote. It was against the number of people who showed up in the last election, in the last presidential election. This is comparing Democrats to Democrats. And on this graph, there's this, and I wish you could see the graphic, this study that was done at Wharton School. All of the states appear above this line of how many people showed up and voted in the election of 2004 or in the primaries of 2004. The only two states who had fewer people show up in the primary of 2008 than voted in the primary or the general election of 2004, the only two states were Florida and Michigan, among Democrats.
I'll have to check that. But someone on the station, a host as a matter of fact, made the representation that if the states that have already voted were winner take all the way the Republican is, that Hillary Clinton would be far, far ahead of Barack Obama. I don't know if that's true, and I wondered what you thought about that. Thanks. That's the answer off the air.
Yeah, you're welcome, Charlie. I honestly don't know if that's true either, frankly. And my guess is if it were true, that we would have been hearing a lot of that from the Clinton campaign. But I frankly just don't know. Barack Obama has won more states, but you know and he's won more delegates. So if it were winner take all, I think logic would indicate that he would be the nominee by now. But I just don't know. You know, it's hard to say. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. Jane in Battle Creek, Michigan. Hey Jane, what's up?
Hi, I just wanted to make a couple points. I am obviously here in Michigan, and the primary, you know, we were told it didn't count. In fact, I knew that Barack Obama was not going to be on the ballot, so I never went and bothered to vote because I am an Obama supporter. But I didn't even know that there was the choice for uncommitted.
Right.
So I didn't go vote.
Right. So, and you think that you're representative of a lot of Michigan voters? Apparently, the statistics seem to indicate that.
At least some. And the other point was that I think the African American community in the Detroit area would be hugely Obama supportive.
Yeah.
And I can't imagine very many of them went to vote.
Yeah. On the other hand, you've got a large white working class in Michigan, Grand Rapids, and some of the other, you know, larger traditionally industrial cities that, according to at least the TV pundits, would have probably voted for Hillary Clinton. So I suppose both sides can make that case. But the point is, and your point, and I think it's really, really well taken, is a lot more people would have shown up. And this is what the study out of Wharton School shows, is that if Florida and Michigan had said yes, if the Democratic Party had said yes, the Florida and Michigan vote is going to count, that you could have expected about 1.15 million more people to have shown up in Michigan and 1.5 million more people in Florida.
Oh, I think it would have been. I think it'd have been way higher.
Yeah. So, what do you think of my idea of seating the Michigan delegation and just saying, okay, 50-50, we're gonna, the Solomonic thing, we're gonna split the baby down the middle.
Yeah, the thing that frustrates me, and obviously I'm an Obama supporter, so I mean but the thing that frustrates me about the Clinton campaigns. You know, back in October, there's statements that she made. She knew these votes weren't going to count.
Right.
When she was campaigning in New Hampshire, she didn't want to upset those people by siding with Michigan, saying, well, you know, because those New Hampshire people are real, and Iowa people are real into having their vote first.
No, I understand, Jane, and she's been on both sides of that issue to some extent, although I don't think it's to a huge extent. But you're right, and I'm not sure that Obama has. I think he's been relatively silent on the issue, which has been interpreted in a variety of ways. Jerry in Miami, Florida, listening on WINS. Hey, Jerry.
Hey, good afternoon. Hey, I need to take issue with the fact that Florida Democrats didn't come out to vote. Now, listen to this. 1.75 million Democrats voted in the Florida primary for a presidential candidate.
Yeah, it was.
Which is almost 42% of the registered Democrats in the whole state.
Right.
And the only reason we had such a high turnout was because of the constitutional amendment revising property taxes. It was a pocketbook issue.
Mm-hmm.
And I got to tell you, I seriously doubt that study, which says that if the vote for the primary candidate would have counted, we would have doubled the percentage of Democrats who come out. To say that 80% of Democrats would have come out just doesn't.
No, it's not suggesting that it's not suggesting that it would have doubled. The exact number is, and I quoted it wrong the last time I said it here. Let me just read the sentence in the Wall Street Journal. Based on record Democratic turnout in other states, Florida would have been expected to turn out an additional 1.15 million voters, and Michigan would have turned out another 715,000 voters.
But, you know, out of the total number of people who actually came out to vote, both Republicans and Democrats, out of the 4.5 million or 4.2 million people who voted, almost 95% of them voted for a candidate. The undervote, you know, who didn't vote for anybody, was relatively small.
Right. Well, I mean, if you're there, what the heck? I mean, yeah, no, I'm not disagreeing. And that's why I said for Florida, since Barack Obama was on the ballot in Florida, even though neither of the candidates campaigned in the state and arguably Hillary Clinton had higher name recognition, having been first lady and being a senator and all that. But setting all that aside, because Obama also was advertising on, you know, buying national ads on CNN that came into Florida. So I think that all of the arguments that can be made on either side kind of cancel each other out. What about my suggestion that Florida be seated based on Hillary Clinton got, what, 53% of the vote, as I recall?
Yeah, something like that.
So give her 53% of the delegates, give 47% of the delegates to Barack Obama, seat the Florida delegation.
I would yes to that, but I would also suggest that they seat the delegations and that when the roll call comes around for them to vote and cast their delegates, that they're the very last ones who participate in that procedure, because I predict by that time those votes or those delegate counts will be irrelevant.
Or seat them all as delegates at large and let them become superdelegates.
Well, if you can convince Hillary, I think that would probably be a good solution. But
yeah.
she's so concerned about the superdelegates, you know, honoring the votes of the states and not jumping ship.
Yeah. Well, we'll see how it shakes out. Jerry, thanks for the call. Doug in Royal Oak, Michigan, listening on WDTW in Detroit. Hey, Doug.
Hey, good afternoon, Tom. How are you today?
I'm great, but I'll get better. How about you?
I am as well. We're doing very well here in Michigan. I just wanted to beg to differ with you on most, if not all, of the ballots in Michigan. Because the primary was moved from April to January, there were hardly any other things on the ballot. It was basically you go in, you pick which side you wanted to vote, Republican or Democrat, and that was the only thing on the ballot.
Mm-hmm.
Not, you know, there were other things. My state representative, I'm in Joel Nolenberg's district, which Gary Peters will be running against. Nancy Skinner ran against him last time.
Sure.
Shout out to Nancy. But
yep.
The long story short is she wasn't even on the ballot there to be a choice between. So there was nothing on the ballot.
Well, here's a question, Doug, because we have a half a minute here before the break is going to begin. You know, I grew up in Michigan, and all my family still lives in Michigan. My three brothers and cousins and my mother's still there. And I get back there 2-3 times a year. And I'm, you know, I know Michigan. I know Michigan really well. And I remember when Jack Kevorkian's lawyer was selected, when Republicans crossed over to vote in the Democratic primary because they didn't want to run against a strong Democrat. So they got Kevorkian's lawyer. I remember when George Wallace was the Democratic nominee in Michigan and Jesse Jackson, because the Republicans crossed over and voted in the Democratic race. That's the one state where it's been well documented solidly 3 times the Republicans got into the Democratic race and mixed it up. Do you think that Limbaugh's Operation Chaos might have had something to do with Michigan's vote?
I have no problem with. I would have had no problem with them not doing a redo just due to that, because I really, as an Obama supporter, I thought that he would have drawn less votes due to that.
Yeah.
Have a great afternoon.
Yeah, thank you, Doug. Good to hear from you. See, that's the one state where I think you can make an argument for it, because the Republican Party's been doing it for 30 years.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active.
little man calls it up. Well, the mind keeps getting bigger, and the paycheck's getting small. You know the IRS, they ain't gonna rest till they think they've got it all. They got the bluff on a lot of folks, but honey's, I ain't one. From now on, people my pay ain't gonna be done none.
See, this is what happens when only 7% of all federal tax receipts are coming from corporations. Whereas back in 1952, it was 32%. Yeah, the average guy is feeling like, hey, well, you know, it's been dropped on my shoulders, and it has. So anyhow, here we have these two fascinating studies, one showing that in all of the Democratic states where the vote counted, the number of Democrats who showed up was hugely greater than it was in 2004. Whereas in Michigan and Florida, while a huge number of Democrats showed up, it was not more people than showed up in the 2004 election in Michigan and Florida. And an estimated 1.5 million additional people would have shown up in Michigan and in Florida, excuse me, and an additional 715,000 would have shown up in Michigan had they been told that their vote counted, number one. And number two, this study that shows that, okay, if you want to count the popular vote, then you take those states where there were caucuses, and you simply apportion the number of voters of registered Democrats in those states, and you could take it as the percentage of people who, you know, Democrats who actually showed up to vote on average across the United States, registered Democrats, and apply that. And now Barack Obama's lead over Hillary Clinton in the, quote, popular vote, end quote, increases dramatically. So anyhow, these two studies are causing a lot of head scratching, I think, across the Democratic Party right now. Vicki in Grand Rapids, Michigan, listening on WTKG. Hey, Vicki, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I'm a disenfranchised voter, obviously. I voted uncommitted, and I would have supported Edwards, but really in my heart I was supporting Al Gore. And I feel strongly that we need to seat the delegates. Even if you split them, like you say, 50-50. Now, part of the problem here in Michigan, why we couldn't revote, at least I don't think it would have made sense, is that a lot of Democrats did switch over and vote for Romney because the blogs, Atriosa Eschaton and Marcos at Daily Kos, were kind of instructing Michigan Democrats to do that since our votes wouldn't count.
Right.
I couldn't personally cast a vote for a Republican in this election or any election, actually.
Right,
but
so those people had to re-register as Republican. Was it a closed primary and they had to re-register as Republican? No, it was an open primary. They simply
it was an
voted.
Open primary,
yeah.
Yes.
So in that case, there's no way of knowing who they voted for, is there?
Exactly. So, you know,
so why couldn't you do a revote?
Well, you couldn't take a snapshot of how people voted on that day because it wouldn't be accurate. You know, that's how I look at it.
Oh, I see. So in other words, to say that there would have been an additional 715,000 Democrats showing up in Michigan had their vote counted may not be accurate because actually maybe 500,000 of those voters actually did show up, but they voted for Romney to screw up the Republican Party because Michigan has this long history of this kind of crossover voting happening. And
well,
because Kos, you know, Marcos from the Daily Kos was out there encouraging it.
Yeah, he definitely was encouraging.
Yeah, and I remember that we covered that on the show. Well, that's an interesting one, Vicki. Thank you very much. Mike in East Hampton, Massachusetts. Hey, Mike, you want to disagree with me on this?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. I mean, actually, the point that you just made on Michigan with that woman a moment ago is she very speaks to that particular primary very well. And the fact that, I mean, Michigan is a bit of a mess, and so it's awful hard to see how you're going to seat those people in any way without a revote. But
the revote is not going to happen. It's too late now.
No, I understand that. I understand that. But
So what are you going to do? I mean, to have Michigan have no say at all at the Democratic Convention would be a disaster. It'll be an absolute disaster.
I don't disagree with you. And I mean, unfortunately, I think in that state, you have to look at a possibility of just splitting the delegates, you know.
That's my suggestion. Just split them down the middle.
Well,
do like Solomon did with the baby. Only in this case, it's not going to kill anything.
That is an unfortunate way to do it because it would be skewed against Mrs. Clinton especially since the Obama supporters in that, he did in fact cheat in that primary by advertising his name in the Detroit area. And in fact, the other point to be made.
But he wasn't on the ballot, so how could their cheating have succeeded?
No,
and you could argue that she cheated by not taking her name off the ballot.
Representative Knoyer was running radio ads in Detroit to get his people in his district to go out and vote, not committed, as their way by which to support Barack Obama. Mm-hmm. Not to mention they were doing it for all the other candidates
right.
who had also withdrawn.
So this is what I'm saying. On both sides, in both of these states, you can build an argument that it wasn't quite kosher. And that's why I'm saying in Michigan, where the only name on the ballot of the, at least of the two who ended up, or the three who ended up, you know, the only name
There's
was Hillary
Clinton. There's four of them on the ballot.
I know. Chris Dodd was on the ballot, Dennis Kucinich and Gravel, and yeah. But Kucinich and Gravel and Dodd did not end up in the final three or the final two. That was Edwards, you know, Obama and Clinton. And so I don't see any alternative other than splitting the two. And I like this suggestion of an earlier caller that in addition to splitting those two, splitting them down the middle, let Michigan and Florida be the last ones to speak at the Democratic convention when the actual vote is being held on the floor so that they and have them go in with a loose commitment, shall we say, so that they are sort of delegates at large or sort of superdelegates. I rather like that idea. We'll see. Peggy in Torrance, California. Hey, Peggy.
Hi. Okay. I've been listening to several discussions, so I don't have an actual article to quote. But what I understand is that in Florida, because it was a dominated Republican-dominated legislature, they pretty much forced the Democrats into making a kind of a Sophie's choice.
Yes, but
and
we also have no. Yeah, I understand wait, that, but we also have video. We also have videotape of the head of the Florida Democrats in the legislature saying, you know, basically, don't throw me into that briar patch. That they wanted to go ahead with this and they wanted to defy the Democratic Party. But your point is made, Kenny in Platka, Florida. Kenny, we just have 30 seconds here, real quick one.
Well, I'm saying here is that I don't like your idea about my vote. I didn't vote for Hillary or Obama. Going, you know, picking who it goes to. And secondly, you're punishing the Florida voters for something the politicians did.
We're punishing them by seating them?
What's that?
By seating them, we're punishing, by seating the delegates, we're punishing them?
By your idea of putting the, giving Obama 47%, he didn't get that.
Oh, I see. Yeah, but he, okay. I get your point. I don't have a better solution. 57 minutes past the hour.
Tom Hartman. Truth in broadcasting. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Now, speaking from behind the good old working class stainless steel microphone, Tom Hartman.
Well, if you like war crimes and war criminals, you have a clear choice in the coming election. John McCain refusing to walk away from the Bush administration policies. And the Bush administration policies now being revealed not to be just a few bad actors, not just crazy little Lenny England. No, it turns out she wasn't even crazy. She was following orders that were given to her by contractors who were working with and or for the CIA. And it gets even thicker than that. Welcome back to our program. At what point, under what circumstances, and how should people who were members of the Bush administration, like John Yoo, who's now teaching in Berkeley, or current members of the Bush administration, like George W. Bush, Dick Cheney, Condoleezza Rice, former members, Don Rumsfeld, at what point, how, and under what circumstances could or should they be prosecuted for war crimes? Andrew Sullivan brought this up last week.
The latest revelations on the torture front show the memo from John Yoo, as well as revelations in Philip Sands' new book, means that Don Rumsfeld, David Addington, John Yoo should not leave the United States anytime soon. They will be at some point indicted for war crimes.
And we know that there's already been an attempt to do this. Alan Ratner's brother, Michael Ratner. Alan Ratner is the, you know, the regular with Talk Radio News on this service. Michael Ratner, the founder and president, or whatever the title is with a nonprofit of that particular organization, of the Center for Constitutional Rights, which I encourage you to Google and check out what they're doing, because Michael Ratner's work with the Center for Constitutional Rights is among the finest in the world. And he's the guy who went to Germany and tried to get the German authorities to prosecute Don Rumsfeld. When Rumsfeld went to Germany, he's the one who went to France and tried to get him arrested, get him served with a subpoena. They're talking about taking these guys before the world court. And now even more evidence comes out. ABC News just came out with this report, this just yesterday.
ABC's Jan Crawford Greenberg has tonight the results of a five-month investigation.
The discussions in the White House were top secret, and sources say involved some of the president's most senior and influential advisors, principals of the National Security Council. In dozens of private talks and meetings, sources said a handful of top advisors discussed specific high-value al-Qaeda prisoners and exactly how those prisoners would be interrogated.
So, in other words, here you have a small group of people in the National Security Council, and we're going to name, ABC actually names them in just a moment, who, contrary to the assertions that were made before, oh, these were just, you know, just a few bad apples, and it was just an accident, and the originally we thought it was 37, now we know it's more than 109 people who died in U.S. custody during these so-called harsh interrogations. Oh, those were just accidents. Oh, the guy just had a weak heart, et cetera, et cetera. That there were detailed discussions among these people about whether or not waterboarding and other forms of harsh and degrading treatment, and I use those words specifically because those are the words that were used at the Nuremberg trial that led to the prosecution and ultimately the hanging of a number of Nazis and the lifetime imprisonment of Mr. Hess. Principle 6, the Nuremberg Principles, defines war crimes as, quote, violations of the laws or customs of war, which include but are not limited to ill-treatment of prisoners of war. And this then, actually, the principle 4 of the Nuremberg Principles raises the question, which we talked about briefly on the program yesterday, which is at what point should U.S. soldiers, or perhaps more to the point, since soldiers, you know, that raises the question of the legality of the war, but I want to talk specifically about the waterboarding and the so-called harsh interrogation. At what point should CIA officers, and we know a number of them did, back off? At what point should they refuse to participate? At what point should they even resign their commission, resign their job, and say, I'm sorry, I'm not going to do that? Because Principle 4 says, and I quote, I'm quoting from the Nuremberg Principles, the fact that a person acted pursuant to order of his government or of a superior does not relieve him from responsibility under international law, provided a moral choice was in fact possible to him. Benjamin Ferens was the chief prosecutor at the Nuremberg trials. He's 87 years old now. He successfully convicted 22 Nazi officers at that trial. And he has recently said that the invasion of Iraq in 2003 and the subsequent acts that followed, but the invasion itself, quote, make, and I'm quoting his words now, the former chief prosecutor of the Nuremberg trials, makes a prima facie case, on its face, case that can be made that the United States is guilty of the supreme crime against humanity, that being an illegal war of aggression against a sovereign nation. He laid it out. This was in an interview in his home in New York. It was first published by Jan Frell over an alternate. He said, the United Nations Charter has a provision which was agreed to by the United States, formulated by the United States, in fact, after World War II. It says that from now on, no nation can use armed force without the permission of the UN Security Council. They can use force in connection with self-defense, but a country can't use force in anticipation of self-defense. Regarding Iraq, the last Security Council resolution, this would be 1991, the last Security Council resolution essentially said, look, send the weapons inspectors out to Iraq, have them come back and tell us what they found, then we'll figure out what we're going to do. The U.S. was impatient and decided to invade Iraq, which was all prearranged, of course, so the United States went to war in violation of the Charter. And, in fact, we did. Several months after the invasion of Iraq, the U.N. had to go back and basically, after the fact, say, well, yeah, okay, it was all right. So back to the ABC report.
Whether, for example, they would be slapped, pushed, deprived of sleep, or subjected to simulated drowning called waterboarding. The discussions about the enhanced interrogation techniques were so detailed, sources said, the interrogations were almost choreographed, down to the number of times the CIA could use a specific tactic. Former CIA Director George Tenet, in an interview last year with ABC News, told Charles Gibson,
"It was authorized. It was legal, according to the Attorney General of the United States."
So John Ashcroft says, yeah, sure, this is fine, and it was authorized. It was authorized by these memos by John Yoo. And we're now able to read these memos, just as of this last week or so, and see that this is outrageous. And not only that, some of Yoo's memos are still classified. The memos that the current information about them suggests that they may suggest that during, quote, time of war, end quote, the president can the Constitution says that, you know, habeas corpus shall only be suspended during time of invasion. Well, you know, we haven't been invaded, to the best of my knowledge, since 1812, in the War of 1812, when the Canadians and the British came in, marched all the way to Washington, D.C., and burned the White House. And President James Madison literally led a regiment against them, the only president to actually do so during a time of war. But the Bushies are making this argument that, no, we were invaded. That's what those 12 guys with box, or those 18, the 19 guys with box cutters in the airplanes, that was an invasion. Like, you know, from a sovereign nation kind of thing. And therefore, we're at war, and therefore, we can suspend civil liberties, and anybody can be subject to these techniques.
Also was discussed and approved in meetings of the National Security Council's Principals Committee, a group that included Vice President Cheney, Condoleezza Rice, Colin Powell, Donald Rumsfeld, George Tenet, John Ashcroft.
The meetings were chaired.
There, and well, she continues going on talking about how they were chaired, but well, here.
Chaired by then National Security Advisor Rice. They took place here at the White House.
And you know, it goes on with the report, but that's the basic thing. What we're seeing emerge now as a consequence of Freedom of Information Act lawsuits, as the consequence of investigations by Congress, as the consequence of some very good reporting by several news agencies, is that there was a small group, first of all, who planned and organized this war, and I put Doug Feith in that bunch as well, the neocons who organized the war, they were guilty of the war crime, the Nuremberg-based war crime of organizing and executing an illegal war of aggression. And then on top of that, you've got this group, and Tenet was in the group, and then Tenet has the audacity to go on ABC News and in his interview with Charlie say, oh, yeah, it was legal. You know, it was authorized. Well, you were on the committee that authorized it, George. So what do we do with the war criminals here in the United States? Frankly, I don't think that we can do anything until after the election and inauguration of a new president. I'll just lay it out right now. But what we have to do between now and then is keep the pressure on the Democratic Party and our elected officials to say, do not pardon these people. If a pardon is taken by the Bush administration on the way out, figure out a way now, legally, to undo it.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person?
Minutes past the hour. So, George W. Bush.
Osama bin Laden doesn't get to decide. The American people decide.
No.
I decided.
There
the
you
right
go.
Action was in Iraq.
Yeah. So, George tells us that he decided. And, in fact, what? To go after weapons of mass destruction?
We found the weapons of mass destruction. You know, we found biological laboratories. But for those who say we haven't found the banned manufacturing devices or banned weapons, they're wrong. We found them.
I think he was drinking that day. Is there a link between Osama bin Laden and Saddam?
Saddam Hussein has longstanding, direct, and continuing ties to terrorist networks. Senior members of Iraqi intelligence and al-Qaeda have met at least 8 times since the early 1990s. Iraq has sent bomb-making and document forgery experts to work with al-Qaeda. Iraq has also provided al-Qaeda with chemical and biological weapons training. And an al-Qaeda operative, was sent to Iraq several times in the late 1990s for help in acquiring poisons and gases.
Now, we know all of that is untrue. In fact, Al-Qaeda and Iraq hated each other. In fact, Osama bin Laden was expelled from Saudi Arabia by the Saudi government, stripped him of his citizenship, and shipped him off to Somalia, or the Sudan. I forget which. I think it was Sudan, actually, now that I think about it. Because he had organized a small militia that was going to go up to the Saudi-Iraqi border and invade Iraq. He personally wanted to take down Saddam Hussein. Here's George Bush on the inspectors. And this is one of the biggest lies of all, since we're speaking of war criminals here.
The larger point is, and the fundamental question is, did Saddam Hussein have a weapons program? And the answer is absolutely.
No, the answer is absolutely not. And keep in mind, this was after the invasion and after the inspectors were saying, no, there's nothing there.
And we gave him a chance to allow the inspectors in.
Right, and he let them in. And, in fact, there were inspectors right up until 3 days before we started bombing when Bush pulled them out. But that's not how George remembers it.
And he wouldn't let them in. And therefore, after a reasonable request, we decided to remove him from power along with other nations so as to make sure he was not a threat to the United States.
Right, which is kind of a variation on Bush's main theme.
That when we talk about war, we're really talking about peace.
Yeah, that war is peace. I mean, you know, you all read George Orwell, you know that. Well, John McCain apparently thinks all this is the same thing. He was asked a question yesterday in a town hall meeting, and here's the question and John McCain's answer.
If you're elected president, will you reject the Bush doctrine of preemptive war?
I don't think you could make a blanket statement about preemptive war because obviously it depends on the threat that the United States of America faces.
Would you reject preemptive war? Well, the fact of the matter is preemptive war, without the authorization of the United Nations, is illegal. It's against the law. No matter what kind of argument you make, you've got to make that argument before the UN, not before the National Security Council and Condoleezza Rice. I mean, it is just that simple. Even if Bush thinks...
You say we're headed to war in Iraq. I don't know why you say that. I hope we're not headed to war in Iraq. I'm the person who gets to decide, not you.
I'm the person who gets to decide, not you. And he did. And should he be held accountable for that? For being the decider?
So I hear the voices, and I read the front page, and I know the speculation, but I'm the decider, and I decide what is best.
Yeah, okay, so you're the decider. Does that mean that you're the one responsible? That you're the one who said these things, and therefore now we're in this horrible mess, this ongoing occupation. We've empowered Al-Qaeda. We've turned Osama bin Laden into the hero of kids all over the world, Muslim kids all over. Bizarrely enough, when we had this golden opportunity to pull the world together, an absolutely golden opportunity to pull the world together, and we blew it. Why? Because we listened to this kind of stuff.
If we know Saddam Hussein has dangerous weapons today, and we do.
No, we didn't. We had inspectors in there.
Does it
make
any sense for the world to wait to confront him as he grows even stronger and develops even more dangerous weapons?
And, I mean, this is from the State of the Union address, consider.
This is a massive stockpile of biological weapons and is capable of killing millions. We know that the regime has produced thousands of tons of chemical agents.
Yeah, and he goes on, but here's the
first, I'm asked why Iraq is different from other countries or regimes that also have terrible weapons.
They weren't.
While there are many dangers in the world, the threat from Iraq stands alone because it gathers the most serious dangers of our age in one place.
Well, actually, what it gathers in one place, I think, Dick Cheney said it a little more accurately.
Iraq sits on top of 10% of the world's oil reserves. Very significant reserve, second only to Saudi Arabia.
But, frankly, I don't even think this was a war for oil. I think that this was a war for politics. As Cindy Sheehan laid out, quoting from Mickey Herskowitz, the guy who was hired by Barbara and George Sr. to write the autobiography for their son.
As a matter of fact, in interviews in 1999 with respected journalist and longtime Bush family friend Mickey Herskowitz, then Governor George Bush stated, "One of the keys to being seen as a great leader is to be seen as commander-in-chief. My father had all this political capital built up when he drove the Iraqis out of Kuwait, and he wasted it. If I have a chance to invade, if I had that much capital, I'm not going to waste it. I'm going to get everything passed that I want to get passed, and I'm going to have a successful presidency, end quote.
In other words, it was a war for politics. American soldiers died, Bush lied for the Republican Party. That is a war crime. 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Minutes past the hour. What should we do about the war criminals in the Bush administration, current and past? In my opinion, legislation should be introduced right now preventing there from being any amnesty or pardon for these people so that there can be serious and legitimate investigations during the next Congress and by appropriate bodies, including the World Court, of the crimes that have been committed against the United States, for example, the destruction of habeas corpus, and the crimes that have been committed against the people of Iraq and the world by the Bush administration, and by the people who have been taken into custody by the United States, including citizens of a variety of countries. I think, something like over 40 countries we have people in custody from. So we'll take your calls on this in just a second. But first, hey, I think we found a job for my cat.
Meow, 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 meow.
Yes, my crazy cat Higgins. You know, he was a rescue cat. Our son rescued him from a dorm or a frat house, I forget which. And they had raised him with a pit bull and used to throw him against the wall when he misbehaved and locked him in the bathroom. And so his favorite foods are pizza and potato chips. And whenever the shower goes on, he runs in because that used to be the only way he could get water to survive. And he attacks anybody who walks into the house. And we've been thinking, although he likes us, he's very nice to me and he's very nice to Louise. But, now it looks like maybe Higgins can get a job. This, I'm not making this up. This is from the Daily Mail. It might not be to everyone's taste. It's selling for £50, British pounds a cup. That's what, $75 or more a cup, the most expensive cup coffee in the world. The secret behind the special blend about to go on sale at an upmarket department store is that it is made from cat droppings. While such an ingredient may leave many sputtering in their cups, Peter Jones thinks it is a winner. He's the guy who's selling them. The beans are extracted from the droppings of the palm civet, a cross between a cat and a monkey which lives in Indonesia. The civets eat the soft coffee cherries, digesting the fruit pulp and excreting the beans on the forest floor because they cannot digest the beans. Plantation workers then collect the beans, which are sold as what is called luwak coffee. So, I don't know, maybe there is a job in Higgins' future. Yeah. Anyhow, what do we do about, forgive the moment of levity, what do we do about the criminals in the Bush administration? Chuck in Fayetteville, North Carolina. Hey, Chuck, what's on your mind?
Hi there. I called you several months ago and made the same suggestion, and I'm glad you're starting to pay attention to it. I suggest you get a hold of Scott Horton. He's a well-known international human rights lawyer, and he's on this case already. The folks at the Center for Constitutional Rights, we got precedents here.
Oh yeah, no, we've had Michael on this program a number of times. We've had Marjorie Cohn, the constitutional lawyer who wrote the book about the impeachment of George Bush, on the program. We've had John Dean. We've had no shortage of constitutional authorities saying this is possible. I'm saying we need to get it done. We need to start getting it done. Thanks for the call, Tim in San Francisco. Hey, Tim.
Hi, Tom. I've been working on the Darfur movement for 4 years since mid 2004, and
speaking
from
of war
early
crimes,
on, huh?
Speaking of war crimes, what the government in Khartoum is doing, Bashir is doing to the people of Darfur is, and I was there and I saw it, is another war. I mean, this is another horrific. The two worst refugee crises in the world are number one Darfur, number two Iraq.
Well, yeah, but the International Criminal Court has said it's a war crime and indicted two Sudanese government officials and issued arrest warrants for them. President Bush has said for years that genocide is going on. Genocide is an international crime against humanity, a war crime. And he hasn't stopped it because he has this cozy relationship with Khartoum over sharing intelligence in the war on terrorism. And so on one hand, he says, yes, it's genocide. On the other hand, he's enabling the genocide to go on.
Yeah, I agree with you, Tim. And I can tell you from having been there, and I've got to cut up this audio. I've got an hour of audio of our interview with Salva Kiir, who is the vice president of Sudan and the president of South Sudan. He was the head of the the Sudanese People's Liberation Army, and they fought a 20-year civil war against Khartoum, and they won. And he's down in Juba in the very south of Sudan. Bashir is way up in the north in Khartoum, running the government. And Bashir is leading these death squads, the Janjaweed, into the Darfur region. And Salva Kiir down in the south is very concerned about this. And the point that he made to me, and I brought this issue up with him about the United States support for Khartoum and the United States support for what's going on in Darfur and in South Sudan, for that matter, because this isn't just Darfur. This is all across South Sudan. South Sudan is experiencing an incredible crisis. Is that China is buying the oil that is in South Sudan? They've discovered an enormous amount of oil in South Sudan. China is buying that oil, and China is saying to the United States, whether explicitly or implicitly, nobody knows, but the message is, don't mess with China. Hey, do you want cheap stuff in your Walmart or not? Don't mess with China. And this is one of the reasons so many people are so, upset about the Olympics, and with good reason. So, anyway, Weldon in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Hey, Weldon.
Hi, Tom. I just want to offer the opinion that I don't think we should be talking about this yet. To me, it's just too dangerous because I think Bush isn't finished yet.
No, I agree. And this is why I'm saying now is not the time to indict these guys. Now is the time to talk about what the legal or legislative options are that might have to be, put into place now, or at least during this legislative session before it ends and before the elections begin, that might have to be put into place now so that these guys can't figure out a way to write themselves a get-out-of-jail-free card.
Right. And I've always wanted to ask you, I know, let's say they do start war crimes. I mean, you have to basically start.
You mean trials?
Yeah, the trials.
Yeah.
You basically have to start from the top down.
Well, not necessarily. I mean, in Nuremberg, they went after some people who were not, I don't want to say relatively low, but you certainly want to get the top.
I mean,
but very often in a prosecution, I mean, this is like the Scooter Libby thing. If Libby hadn't known that Bush was going to bail him out, and if, for example, some sort of legislative process or a judicial process had been engaged in that would have made it impossible for Bush to bail Libby out, the fact of the matter is that Libby was protecting Bush.
Yeah.
And he wouldn't have been protecting him.
I was just going to ask the question, where do you stop? Because, I mean, everybody is dirty in this, from the media to,
Well, I think what Nuremberg established is that you stop with the people who have the authority to make decisions and thus give orders.
I mean, do you make Fox News complicit? I mean, in Nuremberg trials, they indicted.
Fox News was not a decision maker.
Yeah.
No news agencies, to the best of my knowledge, in the Nuremberg trials were indicted. Now, there was Goebbels, was it Goebbels or Goering who committed suicide before? I think it was Goebbels who committed suicide along with his wife and their children in the Führer bunker and never made it. In any case, Andrew in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, listening on WPTT. Hey, Andrew.
Hi, Tom. I would like to say that first, I'm not so great, but I hope to get better someday.
Okay, good. What's up?
I'm not a legal scholar or anything, but it seems to me that if you commit a crime, you can't absolve someone else, a co-conspirator or whatever, involved with the same crime. Bush doesn't have the right to pardon anybody if he's already a criminal.
But he's already done it with Scooter Libby. I mean, it wasn't a pardon. It was a I forget the legal word, but he basically put the thing in abeyance.
Because they commuted it.
Commuted it. Thank you very much.
No, yeah. I'm referring to the whole ball of wax, and like you said, we're going to have to wait till after administration change. But then whoever he pardons going out of office, once he's out of office, I don't think that they'll stand up to scrutiny.
Yeah, well, I think it may, and I think if there's any kind of a legal or legislative process that needs to be put into place right now, we should be putting it into place. And those are the hearings that I'd like to hear Henry Waxman or John Conyers having, or for that matter, Patrick Leahy, about how do we avoid abuse, further abuse of judicial process by this administration to cover their own butts on the way out of office. Alan in Hawaii. Hey, Alan, what's up?
Good morning. First of all, before I start, can I first say that there's a lot of people here in Hawaii and a lot of people I work with that are no longer able to listen to AAR, and that's because there's so many people here boycotting the station for the Randy Rose incident, and they're not going to listen until she's back on the air.
I understand, Alan, and I'm sorry. I'm just I am not being censored or anything like that. I just, as a policy, a longstanding policy, I don't discuss other radio shows on this show. It's just this is not a forum for that. Richard in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Richard.
Hey, what's up, Tom? I'm so happy that you're talking about really holding our government responsible. For what's been going on, and thank you.
Okay, and your point. We've got about 20 seconds here. We've got to take a break, Richard.
With the rest of the world, when I travel abroad and I watch the news, I get such a different picture of what's going on in this country. The American people is being deceived by smoke screens, and they don't really even know how bad it's been. And I think we should hold the people at the top, like you said, who make the decisions, responsible. So I'm talking about like the real important players in this.
Yeah, I absolutely agree, Richard, and thank you very much for the call. And to the previous caller, let me just say, I understand that you're upset. I'm upset, too, and we're just going to leave it at that, because I guess I've said enough. 45 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Program, 866-303-2270, our telephone number, tomhartman.com. If you want to drop into our live chat room, drop by, say hi. Stick around. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People.
Minutes before the hour, the Tom Hartman Radio Program here with you, powered in part by the Teamsters Union, holding Waste Management Incorporated accountable in the fight for worker safety. You can find out more at teamster.org. And speaking of the Teamsters Union, James P. Hoffa, the General President of the International Brotherhood of Teamsters, teamsters.org, on the line with us. Mr. Hoffa, welcome to the program.
How you doing, Tom?
I'm great, and I'm glad to have you on with us. I understand you guys are doing this working class convoy for change about the Columbia Free Trade Deal, NAFTA, and all these other lousy trade deals.
We are campaigning from Scranton to... We've been here for 3 days. We've talked to thousands of people. We're talking about bad trade agreements. We're talking about what we can do to rebuild the middle class and, get so people can join unions, change the laws, change America, and we're getting a great response.
Well, and in fact, in the context of changing the laws, in today's Financial Times, front page story, actually it was a front page photo that referred to a story on page 7, and the headline on that page is, Businesses Unite to Fight Plan for Reform. The front page picture was Lee Scott, the president of Walmart, and the first paragraph, U.S. business leaders are stepping up a campaign against proposed labor law reforms backed by the Democrats that could significantly enhance the ability of unions to organize workers. There is a billion-dollar industry devoted to busting unions in the United States, and these guys right now are putting on this huge legislative push to stop card check.
Well, they're scared because the Employee Free Choice Act is real. Both candidates have endorsed it. It's something that will actually be the silver bullet. It will really bring unions back. It'll bring the middle class back, and it'll give the little guy a chance to basically have some say in his life. We did this, a year ago, and we had 52 votes in the Senate. We have to get to 60, you know, so we can have cloture on any filibuster. So our goal is to elect senators out there. Both candidates are signed on, and we're going to be able to change this country once and for all.
Yeah, both Democratic candidates are signed on. I don't think Mr. McCain is signed on.
No, that's right. I'm talking about both Hillary and Obama.
That's right. And I'm curious, by the way, on this program, we're on XM and Sirius Satellite Radio, and I get calls from satellite listeners, particularly a lot of truckers who are, and many of them are independent truckers, some of them are UAW truckers, are Teamsters truckers, who are talking about, and in some cases actually engaging in slowdowns or, you know, stoppages, work stoppages because of the price of fuel and whatnot. Is the Teamsters taking a position on this?
Well, we're not part of any slowdown, but we certainly know that there's something going on, that the price of oil, the price of gasoline, the price of diesel fuel is being manipulated. You talk to all the experts, there's no shortage of oil or gasoline in this country. And what we've got to do is to have a Senate investigation or a House investigation. And if we get the right administration in there, we can get tough with these oil companies and start getting the price of gasoline down where it belongs, because this is really killing America. It's yeah. killing the trucking industry. It's killing the airline industry. We had three airlines go out of business in 1 week.
Right.
Who's ever heard of three airlines going out of business in 1 week? All because of fuel prices.
Yeah.
So this is going to be eventually start strangling America, and we better start paying attention to it.
And there's another issue associated with it, at least for truckers. One of my very best friends when I was growing up went to high school with, became a long-haul trucker, and this was back in the late 60s. I mean, we got out of high school in 69 and or 68, and he went off and became a long-haul trucker. And for the first decade or so, you know, throughout the 70s and into the early 80s, he was making good money. He had a great job. He loved what he was doing, everything. And now I'm hearing from truckers that between the union busting and the passing along fuel costs to the independent drivers and what, that it's a tough business. I mean, to a large extent, doesn't a lot of this have to do with the war against unionized labor that Ronald Reagan kicked off in 1981 when he busted up Petco?
It's absolutely that, and it's absolutely, you know, that the guy working for himself with these oil prices, he can't pass it on. You're talking about the trucker.
Yeah.
He has to carry a load, and if gas prices go up, he really can't raise his rates because, you know, you have one trucker competing against another. So eventually his margin goes smaller and smaller to the point where he's barely making a living. He's driving just to pay bills and nothing else. So that's just part of this whole process of getting rid of the middle class. It's part of high fuel prices. It's part of everything we're seeing today. The average person, you know, sees foreclosures at an all-time high. 80,000 jobs disappeared last month. We're in a crisis. We're in a recession. And we need a new candidate. I'm out campaigning for Barack Obama. But we need change in this country, and we need it now.
That's great, and I salute you on that. And doesn't that even then also lead to a larger and older issue, which is that, you know, a lot of these truckers who would love to become members of the Teamsters can't, in part because of the Taft-Hartley Act of 1947. I mean, let's really shoot for the moon here and repeal Taft-Hartley.
Well, I know what you mean. A lot of them are independent contractors, but we have...
Or they come out of these so-called right-to-work states that were created by Taft-Hartley.
That's right. You have the independent contractor status, and you also have right to work. But, you know, we have organized these companies, but it's hard to organize individual truckers. And if there's a company, we can go out and organize that.
Yeah.
And I think that's the way we have to do it.
Yeah. And although you're still fighting it, literally a $1 billion industry, there are people out there, you know, $1,000 an hour consultants who come into these big corporations and they teach them how to keep the unions out. And it's just, that should be a crime.
Well, we're very proud of the fact that Teamsters just organized a company called UPS Freight, which was the old overnight. We did it because we got a car check agreement with UPS, and we organized 10,000 new UPS Freight drivers. You know,
we haven't
done that in the Teamsters in 30 years. That's great progress. I met some of the guys here in Pennsylvania. They're really excited about being Teamsters. Brand new Teamsters.
That is absolutely great and good on you. James P. Hoffa, the president of the International Brotherhood of Teamsters. And it is great that you guys are out there. It's great that you're out there campaigning on the Democratic side. And thank you for the great work that you're doing. Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you.
Good having you on the program. 57 minutes past the hour. Coming up in our next hour, the CEO for Climate Protection is interviewed in Rolling Stone. ClimateProtect.org. Kathy Zoi is going to be with us. What's the status of our world?
You're in the Democracy Zone.
Democracy
with
Zone.
Tom Hartman.
The Tom Hartman Program. Tom Hartman Program.
Tom Hartman.
The smart people get their news.
Pearls, politics, and power. How women can win and lead. This is the title of a new book by Madeline Kunin. I am, as a former resident of Vermont, honored to have with us the former governor of that state, as well as our former ambassador to Switzerland. Madeline, Mrs. Kunin, ambassador, governor, which title trumps which, I guess, ambassador or governor?
Well, I think governor, since there are fewer governors than ambassadors. At least that's my interpretation of protocol, but it doesn't much matter to me.
Well, Governor, you've written a marvelous book about women in politics in the United States, and we actually did an hour on this earlier in the week about which is a more powerful negative force in the United States, racism or misogyny and sexism. And I'm curious about your take on that question.
Well, you know, unfortunately, they're both still there, though we have to pause when we say that and acknowledge we've come a long way, because nobody would have predicted just 2 years ago that an African-American man and a white woman would be the top contenders for the Democratic nomination for president. But having said that, there still are some issues there. They're not as blatant as they used to be, and they're different. I don't think you can equate racism with sexism, because white women have not experienced slavery like African-American women and African-American men. So it's not the same thing, but I think there's still some gender problems.
Well, my take on it is that sexism and misogyny are actually a more potent force in the United States right now because they are culturally acceptable. Rush Limbaugh runs an advertisement for a one-minute spoof ad for the Hillary Clinton testicle lockbox.
Oh, God.
You know, guys, now take or ladies, take control of your men. You know, and, you know, it just gets laughed at, whereas, Don Imus makes a race reference and he gets thrown off the air. It seems to me that sexism and misogyny are that there's an undercurrent of acceptance in our culture that is unhealthy, frankly.
I agree with you totally on that. For example, when John McCain was at a campaign event and a woman asked him, "How are we going to defeat the bitch?" he just said, "That's an interesting question. That's a good question." Not even objecting to how she characterized Hillary Clinton. So, yeah, there is more acceptance or seeing it as a joke or okay, whereas racism, there's a bigger political correctness screen that stops people from saying certain things. But racism is still there. They may not say those racist remarks anymore, but I'm sure, you know, if Obama wins the primary, we're going to see some subtle attacks in that direction as well.
Oh, yeah. Subtle and not so subtle. I mean, just like happened to Harold Ford Jr. down in Tennessee.
Exactly.
You were the ambassador, the United States ambassador to Switzerland, and you note that it was only 1971 that country gave women the right to vote.
Right.
And yet they have done, they have been far more progressive in their response to the power of women in society than has the United States, which gave women the right to vote in, what, 1920, is that right?
Right. Well, you know, something very hard to explain is going on, and that's why one reason I wrote this book. American women who are so educated, you know, 56% of undergraduates now are women. We play sports, we care about the issues, but we're not present in the same numbers in the political halls of power. The number I came across again and again was 16%. That's the percentage of women in the United States Congress today. And you might say, well, maybe that's not so bad, except when you line us up with other countries, we rank 69th out of 187 countries in the percentage of women in parliament. So we are not the progressive, liberated country for women that we thought we were.
Mm-hmm. And so what do we do about that?
Well, I think we have to really have a campaign to encourage more women to participate. And we can do that by one strategy. It sounds too simple to even be called a strategy, but it is to ask women to run at all levels, you know, from school board to Congress, maybe someday again for the presidency, but obviously you don't start running for president. So asking women to run makes a difference, helping women to run. And women need role models. That's why in this book I interviewed almost 100 women to tell their stories, you know, why they're involved, what the rewards are. I don't want to paint, you know, a rosy-colored glasses picture of politics. We all know it's tough. It can get nasty. But I also think we have to remind people that tough as it is, you can get things done when you have the vote, when you have the power.
Well, you certainly did in Vermont.
Yes, we did. We did. You know, we were able to start, you know, a children's health care program, health insurance program called Dr. Dinosaur, Save Farmland. So, you know, we have to tell more of the good news side of politics, that it's worth the risk you take by jumping into the fray.
Yeah. Well, I think it's a marvelous thing that you've done in a great book that you've written, Madeline Kunin, the governor, ambassador. The book is Pearls, Politics and Powers, How Women Can Win and Lead. And I would like to thank you so much for dropping by and talking with us today.
Thank you very much, Tom.
Thank you for coming by. I want to do now just very quickly a progressive pop quiz here on the program. A progressive straw poll. Where we're going to just, I'll take your calls. When you call in, you'll just hear the phone ring and ring and ring. Our call screener is not going to answer the phone. And we're just going to do it for a couple of minutes here until we'll push this break back 1 minute and we'll just do it for about 2.5 minutes, 3 minutes. And, you know, I'll call out your area code and put you on the air and you can just say who you would vote for if the Democratic primary was held today. Our telephone number is 1-866-303-2270. 1-866-303-2270, and we're just going to take your calls for the next 3 minutes, and you tell us who, and Sean here will tally it up, and we'll and just getting the pulse of our listeners. 866-303-2270. Who would you vote for if today the primary was being held? Area code 305. Who would you vote for? You got to listen to your phone here. Area code 602. Who would you vote for today?
602, Barack Obama.
Thank you. Area code 734, who would you be voting for today?
Barack Obama.
Thank you. Area code 971, who would you vote for today?
Barack Obama.
Thank you. Area code 562, who would you vote for today?
Obama.
Thank you. Area code 505, who would you be voting for today?
Barack Obama.
Thank you. Area code 561, who would you be voting for today?
Barack Obama.
Thank you. Area code 734, for whom would you vote today?
Barack Obama.
Okay. 360, your vote today.
Barack Obama.
406, and listen to your phones. 406, who would you be voting for today?
Hillary Clinton.
Thank you. Area code 503, who would you vote for today?
Barack Obama.
Thank you. 714, your vote today?
Barack Obama.
Okay. Area code 541, who would you vote for today?
Barack Obama, sir.
Thank you. Area code 503, your vote today?
Barack Obama.
Area code 714, your vote today?
714.
Barack Obama.
Thank you. Area code 206, your vote today?
Barack Obama.
Thank you. Area code 503, your vote today?
Who would you vote for?
Barack Obama.
Area, thank you. Area 602, your vote today.
Thank you, Barack Obama.
Yeah, thank you. Area 503, your vote today.
Barack Obama.
Okay, area code 2, I'm starting to see a pattern here. Area code 206, your vote today.
Barack Obama.
Yeah, thank you. Area code 305, your vote today.
Hillary Clinton.
Thank you. Area code 310, your vote today.
Hillary Clinton.
Thank you. Area code 570, your vote today.
Obama.
Thank you. Area code 503, your vote today.
Barack Obama.
Thank you. Area code 425, your vote today.
Barack Obama.
Thank you. Area 646, your vote today.
Obama.
Thank you. 602, your vote today.
Hillary Clinton.
Thank you. Area 575, your vote today.
Barack Obama.
Thank you. Area code 805, your vote today.
Barack Obama.
Thank you. Area code 843, your vote today.
Barack Obama.
Thank you. Area 207, your vote today.
Barack Obama.
Thank you. Area code 602, your vote today.
Barack Obama.
Thank you. Area code 626, your vote today.
Hillary Clinton.
Thank you. Area code 561, your vote today.
Thank you. Area code
601, Hillary.
Thank you. Area code 206, your vote today.
Barack Obama.
Thank you. Area code 253, your vote today.
Obama, baby.
Thank you. Area code 206, your vote today.
Barack Hussein Obama.
Okay. Area code 951, your vote today.
Barack Obama.
Thank you. Area code 503, your vote today.
Barack Obama.
Thank you. Area code 858, your vote today.
Obama.
Thank you. Area code 412, your vote today. Okay. Area code 541, your vote today.
I'm 503, and
no.
Mr. Obama.
Okay, Mr. Obama. Area code 415, your vote today.
Barack Hussein Obama.
Thank you. Area code 734, your vote today.
Yeah, Barack Obama.
Thank you. Area code 913, your vote today.
Hillary Clinton.
Thank you. Area code 206, your vote today.
Barack Obama.
Thank you. Area code 360. I'm just taking these in order, by the way. Area code 360, your vote today.
Barack Obama.
Area code 323, your vote today.
Barack Obama.
Thank you. Area code 616, your vote today.
Barack Obama.
Thank you. 360, your vote today.
Hello?
Yeah, okay. Area code 409, your vote today.
Barack Obama.
Okay. Area code 3831, your vote today.
Obama.
Yeah, 206, your vote today.
Hillary Clinton.
Hillary Clinton. It's 16 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. The true people's radio.
Tom Hartman.
Minutes past the hour. Well, we did our progressive straw poll here on the Tom Hartman Program during the last 3 minutes of the last segment, and I was literally taking the calls in the order that they were coming. And by the way, you can stop calling now because it's all over. We just, 3 minutes is enough to get a sense of what's going on. And we had a total of 50 calls in that time, in those 2 or 3 minutes, and 42 people voted for Barack Obama, 8 people voted for Hillary Clinton, and nobody voted for John McCain. So thought that was interesting, very interesting. The Alliance for Climate Protection, Al Gore's organization. Yesterday we had on the directors of Leonardo DiCaprio's new movie, The 11th Hour. And you can find links to that over at TomHartman.com, and it's our BuzzFlash Book of the Month over at BuzzFlash.com, which talks about climate change. But the real, you really want to get into the climate issue. ClimateProtect.org and WeCanSolveIt.org, the We campaign and the Alliance for Climate Protection, really solid stuff. And very, very pleased to have with me Kathy Zoy, who is the CEO of the Alliance for Climate Protection and was also profiled by Rolling Stone magazine last year, or was it this year, as the nation's top environmental warrior. Kathy?
I think there's actually a guy who founded the Alliance who's the nation's and the world's top
environmental warrior, and that would probably be Al Gore. But,
I see.
I'm glad to be in good company.
Yeah, indeed. And you are. And I was very pleased when Al Gore came to town here. I introduced him and moderated a Q&A and got to know him, a little bit. And I was just astounded by what a really extraordinary, decent, and brilliant guy he is.
He is a modern Renaissance man in every respect. I mean, not only does he have a huge intellectual bandwidth about, solutions to the climate crisis and everything else, he's also got an unbelievably good sense of marketing and great people empathy as well. As I say, it's a privilege to be able to work with him and for him in getting on with solving this climate change challenge.
So tell us about this alliance, the Alliance for Climate Protection's mobilization campaign. What are you doing here?
What are we doing? Well, here's the situation, and most of your listeners would probably be aware of it. Over 80% of Americans are now aware that climate change is happening. But many people don't know what to do about it, and there's not yet a sense in the general population that how urgent it is. I mean, the scientists tell us that we essentially have about 7 years or so to turn the carbon pollution around. Otherwise, we're going to really wreak, irreversible havoc on the environment, on our ecosystem. But they also don't understand that it's solvable. Frankly, the solutions are within our reach. What this low level of understanding of both the urgency and the solvability translate into is that it's not a high priority issue in terms of voting.
Mm-hmm.
And while we have some presidential candidates that have some policy positions that are dramatically different than what we've got in Washington right now, and that's great. What we need to make sure of is when whoever gets elected president next time around, that they make this a top priority for getting new laws in place.
Mm-hmm.
And we've got some work to do. So our campaign is called We. We Can Solve the Climate Crisis. Take 1 minute and go to our website, which is wecansolveit.org, and say, I want to be on the side of solutions, and I want my leaders to take action. And essentially what we're wanting is all elected officials to know we have a responsibility to get on with this. We know it's possible, but we need you to exercise your leadership.
Are you anticipating, marches in the streets or the kind of thing where people call their elected representatives when a particular piece of legislation comes forward? Are you sponsoring particular pieces of legislation? We have about a half a minute here, by the way, before we've got to wrap this segment up.
Okay. Well, it's a lot of those things. Some people are brand new to the issue, and some people are ready to write letters to congressmen. And if you go to wecansolveit.org, there are choices for everybody. It's a Chinese menu of veritable choices on how to get involved.
That's great. That's absolutely great. What do you think is going to be the most potent?
I think the most potent thing I would ask people to do is talk to somebody new about it. Talk to somebody you're not sure agrees with you. Look at our ads tonight on television. We're premiering a segment called Unlikely Alliances, where we're bringing together people who don't agree on much, but they agree on this being a top priority. We got Reverend Pat Robertson sitting on a couch with Reverend Al Sharpton saying, let's get on with it.
Yeah, I've seen that ad. It's brilliant. And the website, wecansolveit.org, the Alliance for Climate Protection, Kathy Zoi, the CEO. Kathy, thanks so much for being with us today.
My pleasure.
Great talking with you. 26 minutes past the hour. Well, 27 minutes past the hour. And Christy Harvey from the Center for American Progress, up next.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
And Christy Harvey is with us. She is the Director of Strategic Communications at the Center for American Progress. AmericanProgress.org, ThinkProgress.org, and also MikeCheckRadio.org. Gay Christy?
You make the revolution sound so fun.
Oh, yeah. I'm looking forward to it.
I'm in.
I don't know if you're probably not old enough to remember the old Jim Morrison 5-1 song, but it's... we're taking over!
I didn't catch it the first time around, The Doors made quite the comeback when I was in college.
There you go. So who's you're the Director of Strategic Communications. Who's the Director of Idiotic Communications over there?
Nobody, actually.
We're
leaving that
clumsy communications.
But I sent you a bunch of topics, but there was one that I didn't put on my list that I was just dying to tell you because
okay.
I know you'll appreciate this.
Mm-hmm.
So for some reason, I don't know why, but I was reading the Weekly Standard this morning, and I like to see what everybody has to say about things.
Mm-hmm.
And William Crystal had just posted something. This is bright and early this morning. It was this very strangely bragging piece about how he spent the afternoon yesterday at the White House getting a preview of President Bush's Iraq speech with President Bush. Don't you think that's really strange?
Yeah, I do, actually.
So, yeah,
the guy is not in government. He has nothing to do with government. And the and we're talking major foreign policy issues here. Yeah, I find it very strange.
And it's all about how he got this special audience with the president. And the president read him the speech he was going to give today about Iraq and whether or not the troops would be coming home. And I found it was really sort of this strangely kowtowing, I'm on the inside and isn't President Bush the best guy ever kind of piece of journalism. Then near the end, I thought it was really striking. He comes out and says, now I'm going to break the rule. This was supposed to be off the record, but I'm going to break the rules here and talk about how President Bush teared up when he saw some members of the troops and this and that and this and that. And I thought, okay, so he's not even pretending to have journalistic standards at this point.
Okay.
I recommend
well, he never
you
has.
Read it. It's very strange.
Yeah, Bill Crystal isn't a journalist. He's a I don't know what you'd say, a conservative hack.
Right.
So, okay, great. Let's talk about some of the things that are flying under the radar screens that really we should be paying attention to. One of the things that I thought was extraordinary is how the Justice Department, which, I mean, going back to Teddy Roosevelt and before, the Justice Department has led the charge in enforcing the Sherman Antitrust Act and enforcing other anti-corruption acts and laws. And,
right.
You know, basically they're responsible for prosecuting both people and companies who break the law. That ain't the case anymore.
It's not. And this should make you feel a little sick in your stomach. The New York Times actually had a big piece on this, but it was a little wonky, and I don't think too many people actually read it. But it said basically that in what they called a major shift of policy, the Justice Department over the last couple of years has decided to not prosecute companies who break the law.
And in fact, over 50 companies have gotten away with murder, presumably in some cases. I mean, many of these crimes that they commit actually do lead to the death of people. You know, whether it's pollution or whether it's workplace safety standards or you know whatever.
Well, bottom line, they're crimes, and the Justice Department are the cops. And instead of prosecuting, what they do instead is pay us a fine and let's sweep this under the rug. No
right.
one has to know, and they make it confidential. We can't even figure out what these companies A did and B how they were punished because everything is hushed up.
Yeah.
And I just thought, can you imagine? I mean, I walk out the front door and get a speeding ticket, and no one's going to hush that up for me. I mean, can you imagine any individual saying, you know what? What if, hey, Justice Department, what if instead of you prosecuting me for a crime, I just pay you some money and we make the whole thing go away? That's called a bribe.
Yeah, I had that happen once with a police officer in Cancun. he stopped my car, and he says, you're going to have to show up in a week for this to be in court. And I said, well, you know, I won't be here in a week. And he said, well, then we'll have to arrest you now. And I said, well, you know, is there any other way that I can deal with this? And he said, well, probably $50 would make it go away. And
right,
I gave him $50,
right.
And he tore up the ticket in front of me. I was.
The Justice Department has turned into a dirty cop in Cancun.
Yeah, I mean,
fantastic.
It's pretty mind-boggling. It reminds me, in my book on equal protection, I write the story of how back during the George Herbert Walker Bush administration,
mm-hmm.
there was a company that was making hot dogs and luncheon meats, and they installed a new air conditioning unit, and it was dripping Listeria-contaminated bacteria onto the assembly line, onto the food. The detector, the machine that detects bacteria levels, started going nuts. They turned it off. Whoever was running the line just assumed it was broken. They turned it off and ran it that way for several months. Over 100 people around the United States died of this Listeria infection.
Right.
And the CDC finally tracked it back to this plant by doing DNA analysis on the bacteria and on the luncheon meats. It took them 4 months to do it, 3 or 4 months to do it. And the Bush administration, this was Dan Quayle was actually in charge of this thing, his Making America More Competitive initiative.
Mm-hmm.
What came out of this was that the company and the Department of Agriculture issued a joint press release and did a joint news conference, which had never happened before, where they didn't acknowledge the name of the product or the name of the company and simply said that a $200,000 fine had been paid and the company was in great shape.
Right. Yeah.
Over 100 people died.
I mean,
you know, we're talking something that if you or I did it, it would be called murder.
Right.
And so anyhow, now the flip side of this is that the mustache of justice is riding again.
Woohoo! He's back. I thought he'd forgotten about us, but he is back. You know how I'm obsessed with Stephen Johnson, the chairman of the head of the EPA. Mm. He's a bad guy. He's a very bad man. And
at least for the environment.
Maybe
he's nice to his kids. Who knows?
But I don't know. I'm just not a fan, and he makes me crazy. And so he's the one who said he went against what the scientists said, went against what the real EPA people said about granting California a waiver to let California put stricter emission standards out there.
Right.
And he's the one who said, no way, you have to use our weak standards, and that's the end of the story. And so Henry Waxman said, okay, I want to find out how you came to this conclusion, because you can't just make that up.
Well, and it's also, you know, we don't need no stinking Ninth and Tenth Amendments, isn't it?
Well, exactly. So he had issued two subpoenas so far this year for different documents. But then in this letter that Waxman put out yesterday, he found out that Stephen Johnson met with the White House right before he denied California's emissions waiver. And the subject was the California emissions waiver, and that's all anybody knows. So Henry Waxman said, okay, Stephen Johnson, you need to tell me what was discussed at that White House meeting. And Stephen Johnson said, no, not going to tell you what we talked about.
He's not even going to say Bush teared up when he...
Yeah, maybe we should just ask Bill Kristol
and
tell us what happened. So Waxman has put out a third subpoena, this time specifically to find out what went down at this White House-Stephen Johnson meeting right before these standards were dismissed.
Now, there are several subpoenas that have been issued against former administration officials, specifically Harriet Myers and Alberto Gonzalez,
right,
that not only were ignored, but were ignored to the point where Congress issued contempt of Congress citations and asked for them to be prosecuted for contempt of Congress. That prosecution, of course, was referred to the organization in the United States that prosecutes criminals, the Department of Justice, which is run by, you know, it's part of the administration, and the Department of Justice is basically saying, yeah, well, we'll think about it.
Pay us a fine, and we'll hush this all up for you.
Yeah, we'll get back to you on it. You know, it's obvious to everybody that they're just playing out the clock until the end of this administration. Is that going to happen in this case as well, do you think?
There's a possibility. I think it all depends on how much the White House is. I mean, they can only do that so many times. And so it just depends on, A, how far they think they can push this, and B, in this case especially, I mean, there's so many states who are suing the EPA over this right now.
Yeah.
There's another lawsuit in the works. And so this could get bigger.
Yeah.
Than the White House is able
to
control.
If the Democrats thought like Republicans, what they would do is pick a very, very high-profile, high-emotion issue. Like, for example, Christy Todd Whitman coming out from the EPA, when she was head of the EPA after 9/11,
mm-hmm.
saying that there's nothing wrong with the air at Ground Zero, when in fact that she knew that that was not the case, and that this was the result of a conversation that apparently Karl Rove was involved in, this a White House conversation. And you know, just turn it into a great big huge you know, hearings circus like they did with, you know, Bill Clinton and Monica Lewinsky.
Right.
And I just, you know, I don't get it why the Democrats don't take these kind of, I mean, you know, it's like it's being handed to them on a silver platter.
That's true. But I got to tell you, no matter how this one comes out, it still just gives me hope that Henry Waxman doesn't let go.
Yeah.
He's, you know, maybe we should call him the pit bull of justice. Once he's got something, you know, it might not fall his way, but at least he's out there fighting, and you know what? That's sometimes all I really need.
Yeah, God bless him. In the last 30 seconds here, John Yoo.
John Yoo, so crazy. New analysis of his memo says that he quotes the Constitution that says Congress can make rules for the government and regulation of land and naval forces, to then make his point that, quote, Congress cannot use its power for the armed forces because it would be unconstitutional.
Wait a minute. How did he do that?
It doesn't make any sense, actually. But
he's been living in Berkeley too long. He's found some of that stuff that got buried back in the 60s.
It's a little nuts, but it's on Fire Dog Lake. I recommend you do take a look. It's really crazy.
Actually, Berkeley's a pretty cool place to live. But, you're so crazy. Christy Harvey, the Director of Strategic Communications at the Center for American Progress, AmericanProgress.org. Christy, thank you.
Thank
so
you, Tom.
Much. Always great talking to you. 45 minutes past the hour.
Tom Hartman. Uncommon sense from the radical middle. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Turning green. Polar bears with seamy lairs go floating downstream. Heart seals have changed color. They're no longer white. They're now bronze, complected, and extremely uptight. Will it be now or later when he gets a clue? Global warming is coming, baby. It's gonna hit you.
50 minutes past the hour. Oh, by the way, this weekend, April 12th and 13th, actually on the 12th, on Saturday, I'll be speaking at the Seattle Green Festival. I'll be on the main stage Saturday at 4 p.m. talking about my book, Cracking the Code, and then doing a book signing thereafter. So if you're listening in the Seattle area, drop by the Washington State Convention and Trade Center, 4 p.m. on Saturday. I will be there. Say hi, sign your books, and all that kind of thing. Ellen Renner is with us with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com from Washington, D.C., with our update about what's going on in the world. And, Ellen, I'm wondering if you saw this story that Nouri al-Maliki disagrees with Petraeus's proposal to delay further withdrawal of the troops.
I did see that, and it is unbelievable. At the same time, the president's giving a speech in front of the veterans of foreign wars. I saw some Condoleezza Rice was there, and the Secretary of Defense was there, and even Cheney was in a corner chair listening to the president today. They invited all kinds of affiliate groups. And at the same time, the president is making this speech, in which I counted at least four times he mentioned Iran, but I think it was many more. This is going on. It's just like it's like a time warp. What we watched yesterday, or when I was sitting in the room yesterday, has no bearing to reality.
Yeah, Maliki is saying, okay, guys, get out. We can take care of things now. And Bush is like, yeah, we're going to stay in. We're going to give this to the next president. And by the way, we may bomb Iran on the way.
Well, he didn't say bomb Iran. He did not go do that. But he said the regime in Tehran has a choice to make: live in peace with this neighbor, enjoy strong economic and cultural and religious ties, or continue to arm and train and fund illegal militant groups which are terrorizing Iraqi people and turning them against Iraq and Iran. And he said, if Iran makes the right choice, America will encourage a peaceful relationship with Iran and Iraq. If Iran makes the wrong choice, America will act to protect our interests and our troops and our Iraqi partners. Well, I mean, he didn't say bomb.
Yeah. Well, Iran is supportive of Nouri al-Maliki. I mean, they're
I know.
You know, I had one of these neocons on yesterday, whatever you want to call them, I don't know, going off about how, you know, well, Iran is behind all those explosive devices that are getting, Iran is army. Well, Iran is basically saying to any of the Shiite organizations in Iraq, including the government, the Shiite government, the Shiite, largely Shia-controlled government, we're all Shias in this together.
Well, and the other thing is, he said in the speech, that we will no longer tolerate lawlessness by Iranian-backed militias. Excuse me, what about some of the Sunnis and who backs them?
Yeah, well, it's us backing them right now. Oh, you're talking about the Saudi-backed.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. I see. Yes.
And then he went into a whole thing about the war costing. Some people say the war costing too much money. He said the relative cost has been higher, and he talked about Truman, and he talked about Reagan, and he said that this is a modest fraction of the nation's wealth. Well, I guess he didn't see the Stiglitz figures of $3 trillion, did he?
Yeah.
So that happens. Then, today, something even more amazing, which has been drowned out by some of this. Attorney General Mukasey was at the Senate Appropriations Committee to discuss the Department of Justice's budget request. Now, normally that isn't such an interesting hearing. But Senator Feinstein asked about a footnote in a recently declassified Office of Legal Counsel memo that essentially referred to another memo for the proposition that the Fourth Amendment's prohibition against warrantless, unreasonable searches does not apply to domestic military action. So there was this other memo that remains classified.
This is a John Yoo memo, right?
We're not sure who wrote this other memo,
okay. But
we know it exists because of the footnotes. Mm-hmm. She asked if that memo was still in force. Then Mukasey first responded that the memo containing the footnote had been withdrawn, but that wasn't the memo she was talking about. So he kind of said, oh, well, that's been withdrawn, pretending not to know what memo was. He then refused to answer several direct questions, saying that he was aware of no domestic military actions. That wasn't the question. She asked if the Fourth Amendment applied to domestic military actions. Then under further questioning, he said that the Fourth Amendment applies across the board. Again, does not specifically answer that question.
Yeah. So, in other words, there may well be a memo from the Office of the President's Counsel to the Justice Department or to the president. I mean, to the executive branch. It's
the Office of Legal Counsel at the Justice Department,
right.
Most likely, yeah.
Oh, okay. Suggesting that we no longer have, that the Fourth Amendment no longer applies to you and me.
Right.
The Fourth Amendment that says that we should be secure in our homes.
Jake Capoli, who you've sort of yet to talk to, is... Jay, as you know, is an attorney.
Right.
And he said, Ellen, if the military can... If the Fourth Amendment does not apply to domestic military actions, how is it that they can't come into your house and look for terrorists?
Right. So I mean, you know, this is like they've done away with habeas corpus. They've done away with freedom of speech with the free speech zones. The illegal domestic wiretapping. This is that on steroids, really.
Yes.
Yeah,
also, exactly. Senator Mikulski, I always get confused between that and the union guy, asked 6 years after 9/11, how come we still don't have systems to correct errors in the terrorist watch list?
Yeah, especially now that it's being given to corporations who are denying people credit for things because they're on the list.
Exactly. And he responded, it was a complex problem, technology was helping some. And he cited spelling of names, stuff we've heard a million times.
Yeah. And plus, we've got to be able to scare people. Ellen Radner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Ellen, thank you so much. Always great talking with you. Coming up tomorrow, Brunch with Bernie. Senator Bernie Sanders taking your calls on any topic. Plus, Anything Goes Friday, you get to choose the topic. We'll be taking your calls throughout the day. And the best of the rest of the news right here on the Tom Hartman Radio Program, your radio support group for We the People. And don't forget, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit TomHartmanRadio.com.